Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. On today's show, Laura Purcell on her latest novel, The Whispering Muse. Laura Purcell is a former bookseller living in Colchester, Essex, with her husband and pet guinea pigs. She is the author of 6 previous novels, among them gothic novel The Silent Companions, which was a Radio 2 and Zoe Ball ITV book club pick, and The Shape of Darkness, winner of the inaugural Fingerprint Award for Historical Crime Book of the Year. Her short story, The Chillingham Chair, was included in the Haunting Season anthology, which was an instant Sunday Times bestseller. She also wrote Roanoke Falls, a dramatic podcast for Realm, working with John Carpenter and Sandy King Carpenter. Today we're going to be talking about Laura's latest novel, which is The Whispering Muse. Laura, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us first of all how you would describe The Whispering Muse.
Well, The Whispering Muse is set in a Victorian theatre and it follows Jenny from the costume department. Now, she's been sent to spy on upcoming actress Lilith Erickson, who's been dazzling the crowds with a seemingly superhuman talent. But as Jenny gets to know Lilith more, she begins to suspect that maybe a dark pact lies behind this talent and that it might have repercussions not only for Lilith, but for everybody at the theatre.
So tell us some more about Jenny. Who is she when we first meet her? She's the narrator of the story. It's a first-person narration, so we see the story from Jenny's perspective. And tell us what the situation is that she's in at the beginning of the book.
So Jenny's led quite a difficult life. Her father left when she was young. Her mother's passed away, and she's got 3 younger siblings to look after. She was previously working as a maid, but then she was fired from that because of something her elder brother did. Her elder brother stole from her employer and he's run out on the family, run off to America to start a new life and kind of left her to pick up the pieces. So at the start of the novel, she's quite desperate. She's got no job. She's trying to make ends meet and she hasn't got a reference from her former employer to get some more work. So she's offered a job by the former employer of her brother before he ran away at the Mercury Theatre. And it seems like a dream come true because it's really good money. It's a really interesting job. She's always been fascinated by the theatre. But obviously the catch of this job is that she has to spy on one of the actresses. So she's already sort of making a pact of her own with the theatre's owner.
So this is Mrs. Dyer, the wife of the, I guess it's her money. So she's really the owner of the yes. theatre, but the theatre is managed by her husband. So tell us something more about her, who she is and why she might want to hire Jenny.
It's all a bit of a tangled web. So Mrs. Dyer was an heiress and she married a poorer man and they've started this theatre together. And as you say, being her husband, he has kind of control over the money and the theatre, but she feels a deep sense of ownership in it because it was her money that bought it. And Lilith Erickson, this fantastic actress, is his protege, but she's noticed that her husband's paying a lot of attention to Lilith and she's very jealous of that. As the book goes on, you find out she's got other reasons for this jealousy, including her mistreating Mrs. Dyer's favourite actor. And as the book goes on, she gets more and more reasons to be jealous of Lilith. So Jenny finds herself in quite an awkward position because she's making friends with Lilith, getting to know her better. But in the same way that Lilith is Mr. Dyer's protege, she's very much the protege of Mrs. Dyer and reliant on her goodwill for her to keep her job and keep her family with a roof over their head.
So tell us a bit more about Lilith Erickson then. So she's this actress, as you said, she's the new leading lady at the theatre. She's Mr. Dyer's protege. And tell us something about where she comes from.
So she seems to have quite a sketchy background from what Jenny can tell. Conversations with her seem to imply that she might have been illegitimate. She certainly doesn't seem to have any family or friends. She seems quite isolated. She used to work with an actor called Eugene Greaves, who was also very brilliant. But at the beginning of the book, Jenny sees this actor die quite horribly on stage. So there's this mystery about their connection. And Lilith is obsessed with becoming the greatest actress. She's very reliant on the theatre for feelings of love and support. She's obsessed with becoming a great actress, and it affects everything she does.
So there's a fourth character that I'd like to talk about who, well, maybe features in the book, maybe not. We won't give too much away about what's going to happen with the story, but I'm talking about Melpomene.
Yeah.
So tell us who, I mean, I guess in, not in the story, but in Greek myth, who she was.
Yeah. Well, I've always been fascinated by the theatre masks that appear, you know, in theatres, the comedy and tragedy masks. And I remember a long time ago, I was sort of looking to think, like, what was the name for those masks? Are they just called theatre masks? And I found out that the smiling one represents comedy and the comic muse Thalia, and the frowning one represents tragedy and the tragic muse Melpomene. So I really love this idea of having a tragic muse, because I love tragic plays. I really love Shakespeare's tragedies and a really good fascination for them. So I love this idea of the muse being a sort of physical presence, being able to, in a very sort of Phantom of the Opera kind of way, being able to influence someone's acting. So, yeah, like you said, it's very much my version of Melpomene. And there's some questions about whether it really is her in the book. In terms of the actual, you know, the Greek muse, again, she's quite a shadowy figure herself. There's not an awful lot I could find out about her, but she was originally the muse for song and dance, which seems quite a big change to go from that to tragedy. So, yeah, it was really fascinating finding out all the different little myths and how they'd changed over the years. But it's very much not a classical Greek myth retelling. It's my own version of her.
So the Mercury Theatre, which is incredibly vividly recreated in the book, tell us something about this place. Describe it for us.
So I actually named it after my local theatre in Colchester, which is also called the Mercury. And it's a wonderful place. I've always loved the theatre, and I think the old Victorian theatres are amazing. You know, when you go to them, they might not actually be that comfortable or that convenient in terms of toilets and things. I was in the Harold Pinter Theatre yesterday, which was built in the 1880s, which is kind of around the time my book is set. And it's just, you know, it's so gorgeously decorated, but it was quite impractical in the balcony with a very little leg room. But I think it was a real escape for Victorian people to go there, especially sort of with working classes who would be either be, you know, up in the gods or at the back in the pit. Just seeing colours and effects and a sort of portal to life that you wouldn't really get to see in your sort of everyday life. So it's very much a place of magic and wonder, but there's this dark undercurrent as Lilith begins to act there that suggests it's kind of all turning a bit to rot and ashes as her career progresses.
You paint a really vivid portrayal of how these theatres actually work, all the various different people and the various levels of the theatre. And tell us something about the research you did into Victorian theatre for the book.
Yeah, I did a lot. And it was probably about 2 years ago that I did all this research. So I'm sorry if I'm a bit sketchy on remembering all of the things that I've read. But I read, you know, a lot of accounts of how everything would be set up. And most interestingly, I read memoirs of two big actresses of the time. One was Ellen Terry and the other one was Sarah Bernhardt, who's a French actress. And it really sort of came alive through their memoirs of seeing how they'd lived their day-to-day life. And it was really interesting to see the different approaches because Sarah Bernhardt was a tragic actress mainly. She was such a fun character. She was sort of a typical diva, and she used to get into terrible trouble with her managers and throw fits of rage where she'd get so angry that she'd faint or she'd spew blood. She really gave them hell from what I could see. And the public very much saw her as a kind of a mythical kind of vampire figure on stage, whereas Ellen Terry was the opposite. She was seen as in very soft and womanly roles. And she was, you know, considered like the public's darling, just, you know, this really nice, soft, angelic sort of womanly presence. So that really opened my eyes to life inside the theatre and just how women were treated as well. That was something that really fascinated me.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You listen to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Laura Purcell about her new book, The Whispering Muse. And Laura, you just mentioned that the research you did in the theatre took place a couple of years ago. In the acknowledgements to the book, you talk about how this book started in a very different place and has changed a lot over the course of the writing of it. So can you tell us something about how that book came together?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. And I was writing it sort of through lockdown and through some very difficult personal circumstances. I knew I wanted to write a book about the theatre, a creepy theatre, because of my love for it. And also I'd kind of pitched a book to my publisher as having a Phantom of the Opera vibes. So I knew I wanted to write spooky theatre. But when I first started off thinking about it, I wanted more Victorian plays to take precedence in it. I was concentrating very much on popular plays of the time and also on something called The Ghost Melody, which was my original title. In my research, I came across this play called The Corsican Brothers that had a ghost in it. And there was a specific tune written for when the ghost appeared, and it became very popular in Victorian times. And I was trying to tie that in with my story and the different trapdoors in the stage, because I also found out that the trapdoors were named for specific plays. So there was the Corsican trap, which this ghost in the Corsican Brothers glides up to the music. There was the vampire trap, which was designed for the play The Vampire, in which he disappears down it at the end. And another one called the star trap that they shoot people up through. And there was the grave trap, which was named for Hamlet because it's what they would use for peering over Yorick's grave. So I had all these things I wanted to tie together. And I found out that they sometimes called the understage area hell. And I thought, oh, you know, I've got all these gothic things like ghost things, but I was trying to put too much into it. And it just kind of stalled and I kept stopping and starting again. And I talked about it with my agent and she sort of pointed out that the main story was kind of in something that had happened in the past in my draft I'd got to. She said, well, the really interesting part is these characters who don't really appear. So I rethought the whole thing around them and then I refocused it and I found, you know, a really fascinating and tragic sort of tidbit from the past that really solidified my ideas for the novel. And it was to do with an opera singer who was called Frederick Federici. And he died in 1888 in a theatre. He died in these really tragic circumstances. So he was playing in the opera Faust, which, as most people know, is about someone who makes a deal with the devil. And he was playing the part of the devil, Mephistopheles. You know, he gave a great performance, but at the end of the play, the devil was meant to go through the trapdoor back to hell. And he got to that bit, went through the trapdoor, and at that moment had a fatal heart attack. And they took him to the green room and tried to revive him. But, you know, he'd died at that really, you know, awful moment of meant to be plunging back to hell. So that really got my mind turning. And I started to think about, you know, what would it be like if an actor had made a kind of Faustian pact for success?
So the book is structured following the, I guess, the seasons of a year in the theatre as they put on various different plays. So we start with Macbeth.
Of course.
we end up with, I wasn't going to mention them, but you've done it now because it is sort of the theme of the novel. But it ends up with Dr. Faustus. No, with Faust. Yeah. Not Dr. Faustus is the version of it that Eugene is that dies in at the beginning of the novel.
Yeah.
We end with Faust, and they go through Romeo and Juliet. But also another tragedy, the Duchess of Malfi, which I think is probably the one of all of those that people would be least familiar with.
Yes.
So would you just give us a bit of a taste of what the Duchess of Malfi is?
Yeah, I had to get that in there because I started it at A-level and I just fell in love with it. I just think it's really brilliant. It's a play by John Webster, you know, kind of maybe a little bit, kind of a contemporary of Shakespeare, a few years out. But it's a revenge tragedy about a woman who is a widow and a wealthy duchess. She falls in love with her servant and marries him in secret. But she's got two very jealous brothers. One is a cardinal. And one is her twin brother, Ferdinand. And between them, they're so jealous for like the honour of their family that they conspire to sort of torture and emotionally torture and in the end have her killed. And it's about someone seeking revenge for that. It's such a powerful play. It's got, you know, echoes of things like Othello. But, you know, it's also tremendous fun. It's got some great comedy moments as well. And it was a play I really loved. And it's, you know, it's full on revenge tragedy. There's lots of murder and blood and gore. And I would really urge anyone that hasn't, you know, read it or seen it to watch it. You can actually rent it on Globe Player. There's an online subscription. It's not really a subscription service because you can pay as you go. But, you know, like an online access theatre, the Globe Player, you can watch all kinds of past productions of Shakespearean plays. I think Dr. Faustus is on there as well, actually. But I'd really recommend it to anyone because it's, you know, it's not as well known as Shakespeare, but I feel it deserves to be because it's amazing.
Can we just talk about your love of writing Gothic fiction in general? Mm. The book is great. It's spooky, but it's also quite violent. There's some really good gory bits in it as well. Just tell us something about writing this sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I've got very mixed tastes and, you know, whilst I do love happy things and romance as well, I'm also a big horror fan. And when I wrote The Silent Companions back in, well, it was 2017 it was published. Yeah, the original draft of that was very much a horror novel when I saw myself as going into horror writing. But there is quite a lot of snobbery about horror writing in the literary world. And they tend to be kind of okay with you doing ghosts, but not really anything else like vampires or anything along those lines. So I've kind of fallen into this more gothic niche, which is very interesting to me because it's about duality and sort of liminal spaces, things being neither one thing or the other. And I really enjoy that from a psychological perspective, because whilst it's really satisfying to have something like a crime novel where everything is explained at the end and tied up with a bow, in real life, you don't really get many situations like that. You know, everybody has a different perspective on things that happened, and you kind of have to look at the evidence and decide what you're going to believe. So what I like to do in my novels is, especially when they deal with the supernatural, is to have sort of two explanations for what could have happened. One of them, you know, will be a ghostly resolution to it. But I'm very aware that, you know, I'll have a lot of readers that won't be satisfied with that. And so I also like to have a psychological explanation for what happened, and that you could look at both explanations and they'd both be equally plausible. And you sort of have to decide for yourself which one it was.
In thinking about influences in Gothic fiction, obviously there are real obvious classic touchstones for this. Are there more contemporary Gothic writers that you like?
Yeah, I mean, the good thing about the Gothic is it's such a broad genre, really. You know, you have the Victorian Gothic and the female Gothic, which I tend to focus on. But, you know, you've got Southern Gothic, you've got urban Gothic, you've got, you know, the more I look into it, you've got all kinds of Gothic writing I hadn't even thought about. Like in the modern day, I think, you know, no one does it better than Sarah Waters. She does amazing novels that have this element of otherworldliness to them, especially her book Affinity. That was incredible. It's about a woman that's in prison, and she's a spirit medium, and there's a lady visiting her and is trying to investigating her claims about being a spirit medium, and she starts off very skeptical, but she gets drawn into this dark web of deceit. Susan Hill has done some great Gothic as well, Victorian Gothic, like The Woman in Black, which is a huge influence on me. It was the first sort of book that really scared me.
You said you're a horror fan as well, and I cannot obviously let you go without asking you what it was like to work with John Carpenter then. So tell us something about the podcast.
Oh, I guess it's such an amazing opportunity to work on Roanoke Falls. I was approached by Realm, who were partnering with the Carpenters to do a podcast. And they kind of came to me with the story and what they wanted. And I kind of had to do sort of a writing audition in a way that had to get approved by John Carpenter and Sandy Carpenter. And that was hugely nerve-wracking. but I gave it my all, and it got approved. And then the series, I did a pilot and that got greenlit. So yeah, it was just really, it was a huge boost for me. You know, although I didn't get to work directly with the Carpenters, it was always so like amazing when they approved something and said they liked it, because I felt that sort of glow of having, you know, your horror icon approve of something you've written. But I feel that maybe because Roanoke Falls, it's kind of like a historical slasher. It's set around the time of the original Roanoke settlement. You know, it's got a historical flavour, but I wouldn't say it's entirely historically accurate. And, you know, and someone is stalking the camp and killing people. So I got to sort of flex my horror wings and go full gore on that one. So I think people sort of say to me that The Whispering Muse has probably got more sort of blood in it than my other novels. And I feel, you know, some of that is natural in like the time of the theatre and because of the themes and the revenge tragedies. But I also feel like maybe I was still in John Carpenter slasher mode while writing it.
It's also as good as any answer to what happened at Roanoke anyway, because nobody knows.
That's it. That's the great thing about a mystery, isn't it? And, you know, it was huge fun to write. I really did. I really did enjoy it. And it was nice to do something that was just pure horror.
To finish it off then, can I get you to read us a bit?
Yeah, sure. So I'm going to read you a bit from The Whispering Muse when Lilith starts to display her amazing talent. Applause thundered through the auditorium. Shouts of bravo came from the stalls. Boys in the gallery stuck their fingers in their mouths and whistled. Thanks to Lilith, it hadn't been a play. It was an assault on the senses, a feverish malady. Cast reappeared to a wild ovation, but the curtain calls were for Lady Macbeth and Lady Macbeth alone. She stood dazed on the apron of the stage, as if she couldn't quite comprehend what she'd done. A bullseye channeled the limelight full upon her face. She squinted and raised a hand to shield her eyes. A somnambulist roused from a dream. She was still wearing the nightgown from the out damn spot scene. It had caught on the sleeve. There was a rent in the arm I'd have to sew up before tomorrow, but I couldn't think of tomorrow. I couldn't think of anything except what I'd just witnessed. The call boy handed Lilith a bouquet of flowers. Perspiration gleamed from her bone-white skin. As I watched, beads of blood formed at her right nostril and trickled in a stripe to her lip. At last, the curtain came down. Lilith tottered off stage and leant her full weight against me. I shuddered. She smelt of sweat and something else, something rotten. "Silas, do you have those smelling salts?" I asked. But Silas was backing away, his eyes wary, leaving me saddled with the corpse of Lady Macbeth. Blood was streaming now, dripping down her white nightgown. I pulled out my handkerchief and held it under her nose. Lilith draped her arm over my shoulder. Her eyes were glazed. I would practically have to carry her to the dressing room. What had happened to her on that stage? I couldn't get the image out of my head, Lady Macbeth asking demons to fill her. Was it some invocation to her beloved Melpomene? Whatever she'd done, it had worked, and that terrified me most of all. I propped Lilith on the stool. She couldn't look up at me. She seemed to have difficulty opening her eyes. The lights flickered. I could leave her, run away from whatever this was. I took a step towards the door, but it turned out I was like Macbeth, too full of the milk of human kindness. When I let down Lilith's hair, dark strands came away with the pins. There was a grey streak I hadn't noticed before. Or maybe that was the wavering of the lights. I had to peel the nightgown off her slick skin. How was I supposed to get the bloodstains out before tomorrow night? All those drips from her nose and the tear on the sleeve? The lights started to flash wildly. My reflections blinked in and out of the mirror, as though we were caught in the middle of a stage effect. Lilith just sat trembling. It was only when I detached Eugene Greaves' watch from her girdle that she snapped to life. "Careful with that." Flipping the watch over, I slotted the key into its hole. It turned with the grating noise like fingernails across slate. There were words scratched into the back of the case, not engraved by the jeweller. Someone had carved them jaggedly with a nail or a pin. Homo Fuge. What was that? A name? Latin? I recognised it from somewhere. I'd definitely heard it before. "Did you see this, Lilith? What do you think it means?" She didn't answer. Her nose was bleeding again.
So I've been talking to Laura Purcell. We've been talking about her book, The Whispering Muse, which is out in the UK from Bloomsbury. Laura, thank you so much for taking the time to tell me about it.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced, presented, and edited by me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is hosted by Acast and published by 89UP. The show is broadcast on Mondays and Saturdays on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.